Hello and welcome to the 14th episode of Film Club with Casper. I'm Casper Salmon, and with me this week to discuss Robert Altman's 1977 film Three Women is film critic Guy Lodge, who writes for Variety and The Observer. Hi, Guy.
Hello. It has been a long time coming, this one.
Both in terms of how long the podcast's been going and also how long it took me to get my shit together to record this particular episode.
Well, both of us, to be fair. I'm really looking forward to it. We've got a lot to discuss with this one,
I think. We really do. Thank you so much for picking it. There's a lot to talk about. Maybe I'll just do a little recap, a tiny one, of what the film is about. Or rather what its story is about. It centres on a young woman, played by Sissy Spacek, Pinky Rose, her name, who gets a job in a spa in a small desert town in California, where she meets another woman who works at the spa and becomes weirdly infatuated with her for reasons I think we might have to get into. This woman, Millie, played by Shelley Duvall, is a kind of vain and strange character, at odds with their surroundings. And for one reason or another, they eventually move in together, and then begins a weird cycle, a kind of psychosexual, in some ways, cycle of codependency, and the film takes a turn into the magical or into the strange. Is that about right?
Yeah, there are definite kind of hints of Ingmar Bergman's persona there, I think, aren't there? Instead of, there's a subtle kind of personality swap element that is, you know, ambiguously present, I think.
Yes, and it's kind of hinted at from the beginning, but it sort of lurches further and further into a bond that ties these women together in weird ways.
Yeah, very much so. And it's fascinating because it's the kind of very kind of diaphanous, strange kind of psychological murk that you see a lot more in European art house stuff and less in kind of more literal American independent film. And I mean, that's sort of, it's indicative. I mean, Robert Altman has said that he came up with the story in a dream, which sounds like a sort of hacky thing to say, but you actually believe it here because it does follow a genuinely kind of irrational dream structure, doesn't it?
Totally. It exists in a kind of fugue state. But what's really interesting, and perhaps we can talk about to begin with, is the way that inner dream logic is grafted onto an opening which is really kind of realistic and which feels sort of incredibly alive and comical, astutely observed. It's just a delightful comedy of manners. Yep. And so when it tacks into that different style, it is something of a surprise, and it takes some adjusting to, I think.
Yeah, it's genuinely disorienting. I mean, because as you say, you begin with this quite extended sequence in the spa where they work. I mean, that's where they meet. And we begin basically by learning their work routine, which is all very ordered and laid out. And they have to do, you know, this and that, and there are these rules to follow, and they have to wear this, and they have to shower in 5 minutes, or whatever the case may be. And as soon as we leave that spa, which I'm not sure of the exact timing, but it feels like we're there for a long time without leaving it. I feel like we're there for about half an hour or so before we... And as soon as we leave it, we're suddenly in a very different world. And, and I think the first place we go after it is this insane bar where, you know, Shelley Long, you know, spends her free time kind of as this as this, as someone who imagines herself a very sociable person who has no one to socialize with. And that, that kind of desert bar, which is sort of full of strange kind of Western kitsch imagery, does feel like this kind of looking glass point at which the narrative and the characters kind of transition into something else.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. And there are a couple other transition points, perhaps we'll come on to as well later. Yeah. But that opening, as you say, it's pretty interesting that we see these women at first in the framework of their jobs and yeah. of a very kind of public-facing role. And it's a role that requires them to care for others furthermore. Yeah. It just feels like it's kind of piling on ironies because Shelley Duvall's character, Millie Lamoureux, whose name I love, by the way.
Oh, wonderful.
Stunning.
Millie, short for Mildred, of course.
Of course.
Which is yeah. another thing that becomes a thing.
Yeah, but... is so kind of conceited and detached from her surroundings, and she's performing this job that requires her to tend to other people. And that whole universe is depicted really brilliantly. I think it's the Robert Altman of kind of Gosford Park who's really astute at depicting a particular universe and people's interrelationships and functions. And there's a real eye, you know, a real comedy of manners there.
Yeah, it's a really brilliant bit of misdirection as well, because as you say, I mean, we meet Millie and our instant impression is that, you know, she's a bit ditzy and a bit of a chatterbox, but she seems like a sort of caring, kind person because of the work she's in. And that turns out to be very much not the case.
Yeah.
And it's sort of interesting that there aren't many films where we watch at that length and in that detail women at work and the kind of persona that they have to put on to kind of complete their jobs. And opening with that, before we know who these characters are at all, and in the case of the Sissy Spacek character as well, where we get a very different impression of her at the beginning as this kind of shy, eager to please wallflower who then, you know, she undergoes several shifts in the course of the film, which is fascinating. But it's very interesting to open a character on that persona, and I think it probably is indicative of how we tend to view female characters in films, that we tend to assume we're meeting their kind of genuine, maternal, caring selves and not realising that's a front.
Yes.
At first.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And then, yeah, perhaps we could talk about the way it kind of shifts into a different territory with, as you say, that moment of visiting the bar, which feels like a whole different world, and after which we start to view Millie a bit differently, and we see her in her home environment, her insane home environment. I mean,
God, I love it.
It is worth talking about the way Altman kind of punctures that absurd America of magazines and fashion, of putting on a front to please your man, of home decor. All of that's really hilariously observed, I think.
Yeah, because effectively Millie has designed her entire identity, this entire sense of self, on those magazines of kind of mid-century American sort of idealized, feminized domestic bliss, and none of it feels real. But you know, she's decorated her entire apartment as this kind of shrine to that kind of disappearing lifestyle, and you know, the insane recipes that she cuts out and meals that she makes. And,
yes,
you know, when she tells people that she's having people round for penthouse chicken and banana pops. I mean, it is such high camp as well, in a way that you don't really tend to expect from Robert Altman. And I believe that Shelley Duvall had a fair hand in that. Apparently a lot of it was her own kind of input and improv, which is delightful.
Yeah, that feels right in terms of how inhabited her character is, certainly.
Yeah.
And I think so many scenes in that opening stretch, so at the spa and then discovering her in her home, you know, in her own universe, are so enjoyable, so pleasurable. There's a bit where leaving the spa, she's talking to two women who are ignoring her. Do you remember the scene? And they're just there in the foreground of the scene and she's behind them, just talking to them, rambling about some shit that, you know, is completely banal. And they eventually leave and she walks off towards her car. And by this point, they're meters apart and they've walked off. They haven't been listening to her anyway. And still, as she's crossing the car park, she's shouting out over to them, you know, this kind of this stuff that sounds like op-eds from magazines, this, you know, lifestyle psychobabble.
And it's initially very kind of touching and affecting, and you feel bad for her because she seems like a kind of lonely, neglected kind of personality, and you think other people are being unkind to her. And as that character kind of unfolds and unpeels various layers, you know, you begin to wonder, you know, you can see why other people don't respond to her at all, and why you know, there's a kind of fundamental lack of empathy on her part. It's a fascinating kind of character, and Duvall plays it brilliantly. I mean, she is so extraordinary in this, I think.
She's extraordinary is the word. Not just for how weirdly she plays the role, how sensitively, and how commandingly and kind of revealing and unpeeling these layers, but also for just her alien looks, which really give the film this quality that's quite magnetic. And the pair that she forms with Sissy Spacek, who also is kind of quite particular in her aspect, is riveting for that reason.
I mean, I'm so glad there is one film in history that put Shelley Duvall and Sissy Spacek together, because they are possibly the two eeriest leading ladies ever in kind of in Hollywood film, I think. Mm. And they're so kind of alien in different ways that, you know, in the course of the film, butt up against each other very interestingly and with real kind of tension. But I mean, just an inspired piece of casting on both sides.
For sure. So just to go back to this stretch of the film now where Pinky has moved in with Millie and they do start to establish this relationship of codependency, Millie kind of seeming to take Pinky under her wing and show her, you know, how things go in the modern world, how to deal with men, how, you know, how meals are cooked and what to wear, all of this stuff. And this comes to a head at a point where Pinky realises that Millie has brought a bloke back to the flat that they share and where they've been living in this quite sort of what's the word, awkward relationship, a fairly grinding one, I think.
Yeah.
Pinky realises that Millie is going to sleep with the husband of a pregnant woman, the third woman from the film's title, who we'll have to come on to.
We will get into,
And Millie's about to sleep with him and evicts Pinky from the bedroom they share so that she can fuck him in that room and Pinky can sleep in the sitting room or whatever. And this precipitates on Pinky's part a kind of, I don't know, a psychotic state, an episode. It's unsure, but it drives her to the brink of what's depicted in the film as a suicide attempt, but feels more like a kind of symbolic suicide attempt rather than a real, you know.
Yeah, it sort of feels like the suicide of a personality and a shift into someone else. And I mean, I think what's, you know, to rewind a bit, what's so interesting about this roommate arrangement that they set up is, you know, Millie puts this, she announces basically to the world at large that she's looking for a new roommate. She puts this ad up. Pinky spots an opportunity, takes down the ad, kind of offers herself. At no point until we actually walk into the house is it said that the arrangement means sharing a bedroom, which is feels quite kind of quite an extraordinary catch to me.
Yes.
And the fact that they have to kind of share this twin bedroom with these little kind of beds side by side, almost as if they're kind of children or sisters in this kind of antiquated household is, I think, very significant. And yeah, and then, you know, when Millie finally, you know, brings a man home, because she's kind of, she's always talking up the possibility of her bringing men home as if this is something she regularly does. And it's very clearly not. And there's clearly only this one man who kind of is her last resort or her, his. It's not quite clear. That kind of breaks the sisterly bond between them, don't you think?
Yes, I think so. And that proximity that you were talking about, that rooming together, introduces as well an element of sexuality. It obviously introduces the ingredient that is going to tear these women apart, namely that as adult women, and it's presumed straight women, although there is a homoerotic component. Yep. Here, I think, as women, they will be torn apart in some sense by that sexual, component. So yeah, I do think it's really significant. Although when I was watching it, I thought to myself, oh, maybe that's just an American thing from the olden days that women roomed together. I don't know.
I did wonder maybe it wasn't as kind of eyebrow raising in 1977 or. Possibly more like 1957, which is when, you know, Millie really seems to, that's the world she seems to be living in.
Yeah.
But it is kind of interesting also that she has this, you know, she's fashioned this life for herself where she's this kind of domestic goddess in her own household without a husband to, you know, to cater for, to do all these kind of mad dinner parties that she has in mind and to appreciate all this kind of horrible sunshine yellow decoration that she's kind of laid on. And so in a way the roommate is also a kind of a marriage substitute as well. There are so many kind of dimensions to this very odd setup.
Yeah.
And so many things she's trying to be to one person, you know, having no social circle of her own. It's as if, you know, Pinky walks into her life and she's like, well, she's a bit weird and I don't really get her, but she'll do. So she sort of suddenly, you know, pours it all on her.
Yes, I think that's right. It's a really layered depiction of a relationship that is loaded with all sorts of significance. And I think when Pinky, eventually driven to some sort of madness by Millie's, betrayal or Millie's act of...
rejection.
It could be rejection, her transgression of a sisterly bond or of a kind of female honour code... jumps into the compound's swimming pool from a great height. And this has significance because this is a swimming pool, I believe, that has been decorated by the third woman, whose name I've fucking forgotten.
It's Willy, which Thank is you. Interesting in itself.
Yep. Yeah, we've got Millie, Willy, and Pinky for our names. And yeah, but let's come on to those actually in a bit later, if I can, because I think we need to discuss the significance of colours in this film, and Pinky might lead us on to that. But Willy has been painting these bizarre figures as a backdrop to this swimming pool in the compound. Well, she was painting another place, but we know that this is her art in the pool, right?
They're definitely, because the complex that they live in is owned by the same proprietors as this bar that they frequent. It's Edgar, the former kind of Western stuntman, and his wife Willie, who are, you know, a very strange pair of landlords. And clearly, Millie is entirely enveloped in this world of theirs. But yes, these strangely sexual, intersexual figures that she paints, kind of, you know, on the floor of the pool, in, you know, throughout the bar kind of compound as well. It's, you know, in a film about shifting identities, they do seem to foreshadow something.
Mm. And it feels like Pinky's suicide attempt, which brings her into the swimming pool, also has a kind of cleansing effect, or perhaps it's that she takes on some mystical properties of this water, like the old giffers in Cocoon with the with the alien eggs. You know, there's a sense that it shifts her personality, and from then on in the film, she is the one who is in charge, and Millie shifts concomitantly into a weird passive role in their dynamic, and that's interesting and not explained. I mean, nothing's explained in this film, but I thought that was quite beautiful and intriguing.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of the pool as being this kind of birthing pool almost, where she does, you know, she kind of crashes into it, and initially it seems to die, and she enters this coma for what seems like several weeks, and then emerges literally as a different person, isn't she? I mean, she, you know, she no longer identifies with her former name. She wants to be called Mildred rather than Pinky.
Yes.
She doesn't recognize or claims not to recognize the two old kind of codgers who come up from Texas and claim to be her parents.
Yes, a great scene of them in the hospital.
Wonderful scene. And she no longer recognizes Millie as her superior, which is... and it almost feels like she might be a different person, but she might just be an older person as well. Because, I mean, what was so extraordinary about Spacek at that point in her career was, I think she was in her late 20s then, but she had that kind of gift of being able to play almost any age. You know, she'd just come off Carrie, where she had played a kind of teenager, and she begins Three Women almost as like, she plays it like she's a little girl.
Yeah, she's very changing throughout.
She seems kind of pre-sexual and kind of shy and diffident and not at all kind of comfortable in her body or her skin. And then she emerges from this coma as she's sort of reborn as a teenage mean girl, isn't she?
Yes.
You know, she's suddenly, you know, she's cool and she's comfortable with boys and men, and she, you know, she doesn't want Millie hanging around her because she makes her look less cool and she cramps her style, and it feels all very kind of adolescent suddenly. And you do sort of wonder if if it's an identity shift, or if it kind of just triggered a sudden maturity jump about 5 years forward. There's so many possibilities there.
Yeah, and at this stage of the film, Altman has abandoned that skittish kind of tone that characterised the opening, I think, and we're into a much more freighted kind of territory, where everything feels loaded with meaning, and where the relationship begins to feel much sicker than it was. And I think that shows real resourcefulness on his part, and a real, you know, this is where you see the real art of the movie come through, is in probing these quite difficult elements, this quite difficult territory, to really get to the heart of that tension between them.
Yeah, and you do kind of, you miss the kind of cozier observational nature of that earlier stage in the film, because you're suddenly in much, much colder, less familiar, genuinely stranger territory. And it feels kind of akin to the kind of complete 180 reality shift that happens kind of midway through Mulholland Drive, a film with, you know, which would be a very good kind of companion piece to Three Women in many ways. But what you get from this kind of, I think it's not too much of an exaggeration to call it a kind of paradigm shift, is this much more kind of playful sense of what the actors can do with each other, and how they're kind of experimenting with their own personas and kind of teasing each other. And it's the relationship between them suddenly becomes so kind of volatile and funny, and there's a kind of layers of kind of irony there as well. That's they're both so kind of alive to the possibilities of this new world they've entered.
Yes, completely. And I think, speaking of them as performers and the way they interact together, I do think it's interesting that, you know, when looking at this film particularly, it's interesting that Duvall and Spacek's most famous roles are in horror films. And they're horror films where they are attacked, and they are the object of a kind of environmental violence around them. They're in these worlds that are defined by attacks and harassment. Yeah. And I was thinking about that a lot while watching this film, because I think they're two women who are again portrayed in a quite restricted environment, and they're two women who are at odds with society in some ways, and they kind of have to work each other out before perhaps moving ahead together. And if I could just say one more thing on that, on the on whatever parallels I might have just dreamt up or imagined with The Shining and Carrie, there's some stuff to do with the colour red in this film, which echoes De Palma's work on red in Carrie, or which has similarities, I think, because it's the colour red in Three Women that kind of tips us into a different universe, or into a different style of movie, when Sissy Spacek spills tomato juice all over herself, and then at the evening when Millie's dinner party goes wrong, Sissy Spacek goes down to the bins and meets the guests who aren't going to turn up, and they call her Red at this point. And I think that marks the transition from her virginal persona of the beginning to a more womanly one. And that's all over Carrie as well.
I think that's true. And in The Shining, you know, the kind of classic scene of the blood crashing through the elevator doors. And I don't think it's too much of a stretch to call Three Women something of a horror film in itself. And I hadn't kind of thought, I hadn't made that red connection of just how much, just what a disruptive kind of colour it is in Proceedings. But you're right, because the rest of the film is so pastel.
Yes.
It's just, you know, Pinky, you know, that name again, she's introduced, and she's always wearing these kind of strangely outdated kind of frilly kind of, yeah, baby pink
chiffon.
And, yes, chiffon. There's so much chiffon. I mean, I think our friend and fellow critic Christina Newland, when she, you know, heard that we were going to do this film for the episode, was like, you have to talk a bit about the outfits in this film, because they are extraordinary, and they really are. But as identified as Pinky is with pink, Millie is permanently in these kind of wan buttery yellows that she's also kind of, you know, splashed her apartment with in every kind of soft furnishing imaginable, and her car as well, that's this kind of very sickly mustard yellow. And that also kind of blends into this landscape they're in, because they're in some kind of small unidentified Californian spa town that's looks completely kind of sun bleached and de-energized. And yeah, as you say, this that sort of sudden shot of red does kind of tilt things into a more urgent and visceral dimension.
And throughout the film, I think, well, later on, it's Willie's pregnancy that precipitates the final kind of tilt into the film's sort of last 5 minutes, where again we've had another sort of shift in personas, and the three women are finally kind of united. So I think there's stuff there to do with, you know, with bodily fluids, with blood, and you know, with female biology essentially getting to the essence of their bodies, of their being. Maybe that's simplistic, I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think Robert Altman was averse to some pretty blunt symbolism, you know, on his own part. And I mean, I'd like to talk about that title, which initially seems like such a... It seems so deceptive, because you're kind of watching most of the film and you think, well, this is really about two women. And, you know, Willie doesn't seem to be... She seems such a kind of peripheral figure in their lives and kind of in her own life. You know, she barely speaks. We know that she's pregnant and that she paints weird, disturbing murals, but otherwise she seems almost like this sort of... more like this slightly sinister spirit hovering around them.
Right, she's got a kind of mystic quality, hasn't she? With her big hat, she appears like some sort of sorceress figure almost.
Yeah. And you know, when Sissy Spacek kind of emerged from her coma as this entirely different personality, I remember kind of briefly thinking, was this all a bit of a trick and she is the third woman? But as you say, by the end, these kind of multiple kind of personas between the three are all kind of reassigned and remixed yet again. And they end up as this kind of, the three of them in this clear domestic unit that you initially think maybe we're just in this kind of this secondary dream sequence where the rules of the reality have shifted entirely. But there is there's a suggested connection to previous events in that we learn that Edgar, Willie's husband and Mildred's lover, Millie's lover, or both Millie's lover in a way, we learn that he has died. It's suggested that they disposed of him. And so you wonder if the absence of a kind of male figure has made, you know, made them kind of realign their domestic setup, with one of them kind of taking, you know, the patriarch role, and one of them taking the kind of matriarch, and one of them the daughter.
Mm.
It's that final. And it's very, it's, you know, it's not dwelt upon. I think it's only the last 5 or 10 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Suddenly, it kind of blows your mind all over again.
It does, because it completely reconfigures that dynamic. And as you say, I think it subverts all of the setups that we've had before, and it underlines the absence of a man in this new setup, in what's arrived at as finally perhaps a utopia, almost free of men. And it's one where the colours that we've had in the film before, all of these kind of artificial yellows and the lilacs and the baby pinks, have now shifted, and I think we've got some quite earthy browns towards the end. And they're in a cabin, I think, belonging to Willie, perhaps.
It's behind this bar compound again, but it does feel like a different realm.
Yeah.
It almost feels as if they've gone back in time. It's sort of, they seem to be wearing kind of prairie dresses, and it almost seems to be kind of frontier period. And it's completely left to us to imagine whether they've somehow time traveled, in addition to all the other kind of reconfiguration that's been going on.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. It feels at any rate like they've been extracted from the burden of modernism, of this magazine lifestyle that Millie embraced, at any rate. I find that quite a blow, really, at the end to finish on, yeah, whatever it is, 5 or 10 minutes, where finally these women are brought together, and everything sort of, everything has an air of finality, and you kind of have to shift everything together in your mind and to work out whether this is the final transformation, whether this is the last kind of metamorphosis.
Yeah, or do they just kind of swap roles every, you know, every time there's some kind of rupture in their daily life? Had you seen the film before watching it for this?
No, I hadn't. So I was discovering it for the show.
Because, I mean, I had, and that finale still kind of threw me for a loop. I'd forgotten it was coming, and it's sort of surprising every time, I think, and it's. It's genuinely, you know, avant-garde unlike anything Altman had done before. He'd sort of, you know, he'd done psychodramas. There's a sort of slightly mad film he'd done a few years before then called Images with Susanna York.
Yeah, I've just been watching that. But they
all followed a slightly more ordered, more American storytelling conventions. And I mean, he was just having a fire decade. You know, he had made Nashville 2 years before, which is this kind of sprawling kind of quilt of a film, and then he had made Buffalo Bill and I've forgotten the name. He'd won the Golden Bear at Berlin for this kind of slightly postmodern kind of reflection on sort of very Western masculinity. And then this came completely out of left field. I think even his kind of critics and admirers were kind of taken by surprise at the time.
Yeah, because the formal qualities of the film, especially towards the end, are really daring, and it offers up some extraordinary, beautiful images, some properly hallucinatory stuff, and particularly the kind of dream sequence or whatever it may be, when Willie is what, giving birth, or when they find out about her going into labour. At that point, I think we get a really woozy sequence, which feels totally free. And I was startled by that.
Yes, and I wish probably also address the kind of insane score that is very present throughout and very heavy on flute, which is not the instrument you expect in this world of all things. And it also feels like this, a kind of perversely strange choice that does conjure this completely kind of unsafe reality where anything feels possible.
Yeah. It just feels like real experimentation. As you say, he was just sort of trying stuff, I think.
Yeah.
And in this film, I feel like that dream state that we alluded to, the idea of having an inner logic that's dissociated from, you know, convention, gives him the chance to do anything. I admired it so much that I don't know. There's just something sort of unreal about it.
It is my favorite of his films, and he has, he's made several great films that are maybe more kind of satisfying or more kind of muscular and kind of nourishing. I mean, I love Nashville. It's such a kind of there's kind of all of America in one film over there, and years later, Gosford Park is such a perfectly formed, tight little comedy of manners that where everything is kind of, precisely placed, and the performances are all so kind of, pitched to an exact T. And it's sort of the opposite of Three Women, where, where everyone is just kind of trying stuff, but they all somehow wind up on the same dream plane, kind of understanding what they're doing. It could have been such a dreadful film with only, with things pitched only a few degrees differently. I think it's kind of it's a miracle that it came together.
Yeah. And I feel like it was, so just to discuss the history of the film, its reception and then screenings and so on. It was received kind of, it had mixed reviews, it seems. I saw some stuff on Wikipedia by, reviews of the time that seemed to be completely baffled by what it was that he was going for. And then I saw that the film wasn't available to be seen for years and years afterwards, and came out again in the early 2000s, is that right?
Yeah, you couldn't get it throughout the kind of VHS era. And I mean, I remember because it was one of those films that I'd read about and really wanted to see because it sounded so kind of my jam. And I didn't see it until, maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I think, until like Criterion brought it out and a friend sent me a copy, and it it is kind of indicative of just what a peculiar film it was that it was allowed to get kind of lost like that for that degree of time. It did have some very ardent critical champions. Roger Ebert, to his credit, was one of them, and I believe Pauline Kael, I might be wrong about this, but I believe she was on the Cannes jury the year it premiered at Cannes. Mm.
Shelley Duvall got Best Actress, didn't she, at Cannes?
Yes, she was on the Cannes jury, and I believe that, Kael was instrumental in pushing, Duvall for that award, because it was a divisive film. I think it was an extraordinarily well-deserved win. I mean,
terribly
so. That was an absolutely bonkers Cannes year, by the way. I mean, that's the year that Car Wash was in competition as well. You know, America was represented by three women and Car Wash. I mean, that's, you know, you're never going to have that again.
The perhaps we can talk about Shelley Duvall just a little bit more, and then, you know, I'm sure we can wrap up. We've been through it, I think.
Yeah.
But I was really surprised by her and by her presence. I mean, you know, I've seen her in films before, obviously, but there's something sort of newly alarming and
yeah.
and weird about her whenever you see her. And she's so poised and intelligent, and she cuts such an alternative figure.
Yeah.
And this film uses her so brilliantly. And I just, when I was watching it, it did occur to me that I don't think I see women as singular as that in American no. cinema that much. And I feel like that was an aspect of the 70s where women who were alternative, could, you know, could get on screen in some ways. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, she had this brief little golden run, didn't she? Where, because I think, you know, round about the time of Three Women, she was in her late 20s, and she'd done, she had sort of, I think, broken through in a few, Altman had given her her real kind of start in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, I think that was mm-hmm. where she first really got noticed. It was actually Altman used her first in Brewster McCloud, and then McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and then Thieves Like Us, and then Nashville. So he was basically her kind of her lone
champion,
kind of patron through the champion through the 70s. And you know, after she was this kind of fascinating kind of part of the supporting fabric of these other films of his, you know, he kind of finally gifted her this real kind of showcase part. And then, as I was saying earlier, kind of casting her alongside Sissy Spacek, which sort of, yeah, they're so different and yet so alike in their strangeness. But you can sort of, it's interesting to see how their careers kind of diverged from that point, because, you know, Shelley Duvall had a few more kind of, well, she then had, you know, The Shining, which is probably what she's best known for in the popular kind of imagination.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one more with Altman, which was as Olive Oil in Popeye, which, I mean,
sublime casting, was
kind of an insane disaster, but what an absolute casting coup. I mean, it really is the role she was born to play, wasn't it?
Yeah, but in this film she just reminded me of, I suppose, lots of European actresses that I love, in her intelligence and her willingness to kind of get down and dirty and create very much her own character. You know, there's a real act of creation in Millie Lamoureux. And I found that startling. And I remembered that in one of the greatest interviews of all time, Terry Garr's interview at the AV Club, which I recommend.
Yeah, a classic.
I recommend to all listeners. Just go and read that immediately. But in Terry Garr's interview, she talks about Shelley Duvall, and she says that she, I think she says something like, you know, people didn't do right by Shelley Duvall. She was this really interesting woman who had lots of ideas, and that kind of, there wasn't a place for her really in Hollywood. I mean, you know, Altman worked with her and championed her, as you say, and used her well, but it's, obviously, she's not going to slot into other people's films. You've got to kind of create that role for her, that place for her to exist in. Otherwise, she makes no sense, sort of.
Yeah. And, I mean, we had you know, her, you know, The Shining, in which I think she's really extraordinary, and for a long time that was a very misunderstood performance. I mean, one of the many reasons the Razzie Awards are the absolute worst was that I think that was their very first year of existence, and they gave Shelley Duvall Worst Actress for The Shining. And
did they really?
They really did.
And fuck them, Jesus.
Startling performance, but it's also, it's uncomfortable to watch because we know now that she was fairly harassed by, not sexually, but kind of psychologically harassed by Stanley Kubrick on that set. And it feels like a performance very much kind of born out of that distress. Mm. And after kind of, you know, that was 1980. And then after that, she sort of receded. Well, she had, yeah, The Shining and Popeye in 1980. And then it was kind of all downhill. Whereas at that point, Sissy Spacek, despite, you know, also being this very singular, strange kind of kooky presence on screen, suddenly kind of found a mainstream place for herself. You know, she played Loretta Lynn in Coal Miner's Daughter and won an Oscar for that. And then kind of just got cast in this run of prestige drama through the 80s, often playing kind of, you know, very, very real, very
gutsy women,
kind of down home, gutsy American women. Yeah. And got, you know, a whole pile of Oscar nominations for it, and had the career that, you know, Shelley Duvall seemed never to be allowed to have. And you wonder what the difference was, or was it a kind of personality thing? Was Sissy Spacek more, you know, or more flexible, more agreeable to work with somehow? I'd love to know kind of how, you know, what the dynamic was on that set between them as well.
Their chemistry is wonderful to behold, I think.
Yeah.
All right, I think I might start wrapping up, though. Wrapping up. but is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that you feel like we haven't discussed in our conversation about Three Women?
I feel like we could talk about Three Women for hours, but I think we've touched on at least kind of opened up some thinking on the most fascinating aspects of it, and the rest your listeners can, you know, can muse themselves for a while, as the film does linger for years.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a real pleasure.
Oh, this was so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so glad we got to talk about this film, which I've loved for, you know, several years now, and never got to talk about it with anyone else. And it feels like a genuinely kind of special secret to share this film.
Well, so. It was a great pleasure. Thank you so much. I should add that for listeners of the show, our next episode, fuck knows when it'll be, is with Bethany Rutter, and we're going to be discussing Kenneth Lonergan's Margaret.
Oh, what a film.
So really happy to be talking about that one. Get watching it pretty soon, because it's 3 hours and a bit long, I think. But I'll send out instructions online. Guy, thank you so much. That's the end of the show.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.